Welcome to East Meets West, episode 273. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm Roger Chang.
And right off the bat, we have a Google Hangout person joining us, Derek Chen, all the way from New York City.
Great to join you guys this time.
What are you doing up so late?
I'm actually packing. I'm off to Osaka and Taipei tomorrow.
Ah, jealous. That sounds like awesome fun.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Good times in Asia.
Yeah, so you're trying to get your body on the new time schedule ahead of time?
Actually, that is the plan, to actually pretty much stay as late as I can and then hopefully sleep through the plane ride so
doesn't work.
I can survive there.
You always need at least one day to crash and wake up. Maybe it's just my body, but I've tried doing that before. It doesn't work. It's the plane ride. The plane ride really screws with it.
Yeah, it's weird. So all this technology, we still haven't perfected the whole art of jet lag and going from one place to another across time zones.
I mean, we're just coming up against a biological, bump stop.
Very true.
I have to say, when Eileen went to Paris this last time, I was pretty impressed how quickly she adapted. And I guess that just can happen sometimes, out of randomness. But essentially her deal was that she didn't bother sleeping on the plane ride over, which meant that she skipped a night's sleep. And then when she got to Paris, she made herself stay up until past 9. And then she got up the next morning, went to work because she was, she was doing stuff out there. And kind of got her clock forced back on local time pretty fast.
Generally, I find it's worse going from west to east. Like my body has a hard time. I can adjust in about a day, like without having any weird sleep issues going from east to west. Like if when I was coming back from Taiwan and Japan and Australia, I had no problems adjusting back to the Pacific West Coast time.
Well, because you go back in time instead of forward.
Yeah. And so it's always more difficult the other way. I just always crash. It's just like, I'll stay up for a while and then suddenly it just hits me and I just conk out for like 6 hours.
I have to say, it's probably one of the worst feelings in the world when you're really so tired and everyone around you is like just full of energy and you should be feeling good, but you're just ready to crash like in the middle of dinner. And I just hate that feeling.
I don't know. I've been of the opinion that I don't care at that point. It's just I just give me a bed and a pillow, and if I don't talk to you, I don't talk to you. I literally fell asleep while my girlfriend was cooking dinner. It's like, yeah, I'm hungry, and then I just like I lied on her bed, and then I woke up the next day. So
it's that unreality that you start to feel, when your body is trying to tell you it's the middle of the night and you need to go to sleep and it's bright outside and like you said, Derek, everybody's like running around energetic. It just really messes with your mind. I think the worst jet lag I ever had was in Barcelona. I don't know why particularly, but I just could not get myself on a real schedule. I ended up being on this thing where I'd sleep in and then I'd go out and I'd be fine until like the afternoon, and then I'd start to drag. And I'd come back to the hotel room at like 6 p.m. and I'd take a nap. It's like 6 p.m. And then I'd get up and I'd go back out and have dinner. Thankfully, Barcelona people eat late. So it kind of worked out. And maybe it enabled me to do that. But I never could just get on a schedule where I woke up in the morning and felt normal all day.
Yeah, normally it just takes a day for me to adjust. And then usually like 24 hours and I'm fine. I can adjust to the new schedule, but I mean, I have the same thing with daylight savings time. I mean, that's an hour difference, but for some reason it kicks my butt for a couple of days and then I get adjusted to it. But hey,
daylight savings time doesn't bother me at all anymore. And in fact, things like flying to Hawaii don't really even bother me that much anymore. Yeah. Just 2 or 3 hours. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be that big of a deal.
I don't know. I think it's a sign of our times. I think we've advanced so far beyond what our bodies were originally designed for that, it's a natural outcome.
So you believe that our bodies were designed for something in particular?
I think they evolved for a particular set of circumstances.
See, now you said design. I was just curious.
Oh, lighten up, Merritt.
Tom, why can't it be both? It could be a design and evolution.
Evolution
at the same
by
time,
design.
Right?
That's what my dad believed.
By design.
Yeah, whenever, you know, there would be arguments about evolution versus God, creationism, all of that. My dad's like, why can't it be both? Why can't God have decided to create everything through evolution?
I don't disagree with it. I don't agree with it. I don't disagree. And that's why I'm agnostic.
Well, you know what it was, is my dad was religious, but he was also a scientist. And so he couldn't square himself with not believing in evolution. He was a scientist. It's science.
Well, there's a lot of religious people that were involved in critical points in the evolution of the scientific study. I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
And so, you know, it's in many cases,
church believes in evolution.
And in particular instances, it was, you know, the whole reason why they got involved in science was to understand the creation of God better. It's so that they may be closer to understanding the holy works of the great omniscient one. And so, you know, I've always found it kind of weird why there hasn't been more debate or talk. It's always been one or the other. It's a very black and white issue.
That's why I think it's a false issue, because it's essentially trying to replace one with the other. Like, you must have science or religion. You must have reason or faith.
Well, I feel like there's a fair amount of people who stand in the middle, but it's like with every debate, it's the extremes that really kind of get the voices out, because you have to take one extreme position over another. Because, I mean, especially in New York, I have a lot of friends, you know, I'm part of a religious organization as well, that we're kind of in the middle. You know, I definitely grew up in science, but kind of found religion, and I'm struggling kind of in that middle. And I know there's plenty of people agree with me, but since we're kind of still figuring out, we can't really take as much of a definite position as the people who are either extreme one way or extreme the other way. Ones who you hear.
Are your parents religious at all? Did they bring you up in a household where religion was a crucial part of the daily routine?
I grew up in being told there were 18 layers of hell, and went to Buddhist temples when I was in Asia, but then that was kind of the extent of it until my mom started taking me to the church when my piano teacher got her to get me and my sister to go. So it was kind of a weird. It wasn't like a daily practice. It wasn't much until high school where religion started becoming more of an active part of my life.
Like my dad doesn't believe in anything. I mean, he doesn't even do the traditional Chinese, you know, ancestor, let's burn the paper money and somehow they'll be able to spend it in the afterlife. It's like he's very much my mom's the opposite. She's very superstitious, and so she latches on to a lot of things. Whether they are of a particular denomination or religious faith, it's just, it's all the same. It's the supernatural there. And so, you know, when I went to Catholic school, I did the whole, you know, went to mass, choir and all that. And it's not to say that I've rejected it or anything, or I'm never stepping foot in a Catholic church again, or I'm never going to mass or anything like that. But at the same token, I firmly believe, and I think I discussed this with you, Tom, I think, having faith, having some sort of faith, a spiritual faith, if you want to refer to it as that, is very important for the emotional makeup of most people, because it offers that underlying cushion for a lot of the emotional stresses people have to deal with. And, you know, whether it is in a traditional religion, whether it might be a New Age kind of thing where you believe in the earth spirit and all sorts of and sundry pagan, you know, rituals all mishmashed together, or you have some sort of, you know, humanistic faith, you know, a secular faith where you believe that, you know, human beings eventually will find the way. They will, you know, eventually find the solution, the golden pyramid. Well, you know, where they believe that eventually man will evolve to the point where they will no longer bicker, they will no longer fight, there will be a golden age of peace and prosperity for all.
The Gene Roddenberry hope.
I was about to say Star Trek.
Well, and you know, everyone, but you know, whether it's that or you know, a church, a temple, a mosque, or you know, some sort of self-founded religion, you know, people need it because people need an emotional cushion to kind of deal with a lot of things that life throws at you. If you don't have it, I mean, I think people tend to be more susceptible to a lot of cult-like activity. I mean, people often equate people who follow religions or any kind of cult as being stupid or not as intelligent as normal people, when in fact they're actually quite intelligent. What you do find is that they're emotionally needy people that require something that doesn't exist in their life, and they find it in a group or a religion. And you know, when I say cult, I don't mean that in a negative way, but that's just kind of, I mean, come on, Christianity started out as a cult.
I don't mean it in a negative. I mean, come on, cult is a loaded term. You can't mean it in a positive way. You're a nice cult. Like, you got to admit, it's kind of a pejorative.
It can be, you know.
Yeah. It is now, but I mean, most major religions start out as a cult of another. I mean, most of our religions start off branching off and was considered a cult at one point, and I think it's just kind of about numbers before a cult becomes a recognized religion.
I think that religion, the reasons that people return to religion are multiple, which is why religious debates get so heated so quickly. I think it's because some of us turn to religion, like Roger said, because they like the community. They like the feeling of being a part of something. Other people kind of just feel dissatisfied with the explanations of what's going on, and having a higher power or some sort of, you know, explanation taken on faith instead of evidence just comforts them, because then they don't have to think about it. It takes their mind off the hook. Other people are just sort of, you know, missing a piece of their psychology that religion will step in and fill. And I think that's when you start to tend to be more on the cultish side of religions, because they step in and fill that in a way that maybe.
Oh, is that Colleen? I see an eye. I see in a face. I see an eye in a face.
I don't see anything.
Oh, you don't?
No, that's weird.
She's on the moon. I get intermittent transmissions. Hello, I'm from the moon.
I don't know why I can't hear and or see her.
You know why? Because you don't have faith, Tom. You don't believe.
I need the Colleen religion.
You have eyes but do not see, Tom. Oh, I've always wanted to say that.
But that's the thing about religion. I make a distinction between faith and belief. So when somebody says, "Well, do you believe in evolution?" Well, yes, absolutely. That's evolution is the evidence is in its favor. It is the best working theory we have. And like all scientific theories, it may eventually be replaced by something totally different. But there is no place in science for faith. That's the antithesis of science. Whereas you can still be a scientist and have faith in something. You could say, I have no evidence of God, nor will I ever be able to prove God exists, but I'm going to have faith in God. And then you can be a religious scientist. I think that's how it can coexist. Or you could say, you know what, I'm not going to have faith in anything. I'm just going to believe in science and evidence-based things. And that works for some people too. I think what's interesting to me is the atheists, because they actually get almost faith-like about the fact that there isn't anything to have faith in.
Hello. Yes. Sorry, I just had to say that to throw everyone off because it's like Roger's crazy. But to answer your point, I find atheism very curious. For a belief system that disavows belief systems in the supernatural.
Well, it doesn't disavow belief systems. It disavows faith systems. It says let's only believe in what we can see evidence of.
Based on your definitions, yes. And but at the same time, they seem to take on a lot of the same characteristics most people find kind of obnoxious about organized, you know, traditional organized religion, specifically various tenets or denominations of Christianity, one of which is proselytized.
The proselytization is exactly what a lot of atheists do, which I find rather humorous.
I find it ironic. I don't find it humorous. I don't go, ha ha. It's like, oh, that's strange.
Well, and I got no problem with it. You know, I just find, and I guess I find it humorous because it's ironic, because it's sort of like, well, you're there's a lot of, that's why I like the skeptics better than the atheists. And there's a lot of atheists who are skeptics. It's, you know, there's no clean divisions. But the skeptics try to say, we're not forcing you to agree with us. We just think we're right, and we're going to put it out there. Whereas the atheists, sometimes, not all atheists, but sometimes atheists get pushy and say, well, you're an idiot if you believe in any religion. And I think that gives atheism a bad name.
Which is why I'm not really into faith systems all that much. But you know, it's funny. I mean, I've come across people of various, you know, various faith tenets, and you know, it's interesting because the cross section is a lot like the cross section of most social groups. You got your jerks. You got amazingly selfless people who will give their right arm to help you, and then you got most of the people who are somewhere in between, you know, somewhere between being selfish and selfless, and that's kind of the way society works out. In high school, it's really interesting because Modesto, at the time when I was going to high school, Modesto actually had the highest number of places of worship, houses of worship per person in the country. So for every 1,000 people, there were a set number of, you know, churches, mostly churches, of various denominations. You had, you know, Pentecostal, Episcopalian, and the rest, Catholic, and all the other Protestant groups. And what was interesting was, you know, more interesting arguments someone made to me is like, well, you know, I believe in God because, you know, it can't hurt if I'm wrong. And I said, well, you know, that's kind of not being very faith believing. You're just doing it because you think you'll get something out of it, but you don't actually believe, or you're just believing out of convenience, which ultimately isn't really kind of a true faith if you actually were to have faith. But it's so weird. I mean, born agains, I find kind of an odd group, and I find, you know, I don't know. It's such a weird mix of humanity that people kind of bridge under this. You know, title of they're religious, and not everyone under that banner reacts the same way to different to those same situations. And I don't know. I just think it's people are so caught up on that. Or you're a Muslim. Oh no, you're a Buddhist. Or you're a Mormon. You're a Catholic or whatever. And it's just like, you know, ultimately the guy or gal, the person is you know, generally okay. You know, seems like a nice person, acts like a nice person, fine, they're a nice person. Doesn't mean that somehow Mormonism or Catholicism or whatever made them nice people.
No, I think that's a really good point, that I think the problems we have are not particularly with whatever belief system someone has. The problems are usually with people acting in ways that suck.
Yeah.
And maybe, just like people who are in the Southwest tend to be better at cooking Mexican food, doesn't mean that everyone in the Southwest cooks Mexican food well.
No.
There may be certain belief systems that tend to have more jerks or more nice people, but that doesn't mean that every single person who has that belief system is nice or a jerk, or that having that belief system makes you a nice person or a jerk. You're kind of a nice person or a jerk first, and then you pick your religion. And there may be religions or belief systems that are more attractive to particular types of people.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the things I've noticed is people often claim that, you know, their religion made them do it. Oh, they made it, you know, my religion made me, you know, kill this person or do this or do A or B or C, whatever. Maybe,
that's not a loaded example, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in many of those cases, I honestly feel that person would have, you know, done that act anyway, but religion is really just a convenient excuse. It's a way to kind of, you know, set a moral tone so their conscience doesn't get the better of them, or it's just, you know, a nice convenient excuse for their actions without having them explain that they're psychopathic.
It's an extreme of the role religion plays in explaining the unexplainable, right? So we turn to religion sometimes as a species because we just don't understand how the world works, and it fills in, you know, a comfortable way.
It explains
dealing with that. But you could take that to extreme and, you know, become a serial killer and say, oh, I don't know why I'm a serial killer, so I'll blame religion.
And it's you know, how are you going to argue? I mean, there's really no empirical proof that, you know, it's a nice way to at least maybe give an excuse to yourself that, no, it wasn't because I'm a homicidal maniac. It's because religion made me do it, and all the bad things it put in my head. I think, and that's not to absolve, religious dogma and all that stuff. But I think it's too convenient to squarely blame. Well, you know, if the Catholic Church allowed for abortions and wasn't so against contraception and all that, we wouldn't have all these abortion killers, you know, staking out and trying to, you know, bump off people who are running abortion. It's like, no, those people probably had something they wanted to do along very similar lines. Religion makes a convenient outlet, a convenient excuse for them to kind of act out that thought process.
Well, I think.
Oh, did he?
Did we lose you?
Oh, Roger, I mean, I agree with you, and I think that in certain degrees, like, is that really different? Oh, am I coming through now?
Yeah, you're back now.
Yeah,
connection is a little bit choppy, but I agree with you, Roger, and I was thinking, you know, like, in the same ways, like. I don't know. Like, sometimes I feel like religion is just one of those. It's just an excuse or kind of one thing to adhere to. Like, you can easily replace religion with nationalism or certain types of, like, philosophy. You know, what we saw, you know, maybe in the mid 20th century when people were using, you know, certain philosophies or you know, during the world wars to justify certain things. I mean, is it really that different from the religious wars that we saw in the Middle Ages and you know, it's like there's almost this difference between kind of religion, I guess, like true religion and then what's done kind of under the umbrella or the name of religion, mm-hmm. just as much as things are done under the name of communism or capitalism or fascism or whatever these philosophies are out there.
And, you know, my personal view is religion in many cases and philosophy. I mean, it is a kind of a much broader form of a philosophical, you know, kind of look on life. You know, it dictates on how you react and interact with people, how you act with certain situations, how you structure your life, you know, the rules you live by. And a lot of philosophies, you know, follow the same tactics. You know, a lot of political philosophies, you know, pick your ism, you know, capitalism, you know, free market, let the hand decide. If people aren't able to compete, well, that's just because they're not trying hard enough or they're not smart enough or that's just social Darwinism at, you know, playing itself out. And, you know, it's very easy to get caught up to kind of wear these, you know, specific isms on your chest, kind of like a badge of honor or some sort of, you know, marker. And the reality is, it's like life is way too complex to kind of, you know, kind of reduce it into a set of concepts that, you know, universal concepts, that is, that, you know, should work for everyone, because it doesn't. Depending on where you live, depending on the society, you know, was developed or evolved, certain things work better than others. You know, I'm sure the societies that, you know, the Inuit and stuff developed was a much better fit for their lifestyle than, say, the one that devolved around the equator in Mesopotamia or even in South America, because there's so many different challenges, so many external forces that dictate to them, yeah, you need to have smaller groups. You know, you don't have large city civilizations because there's no physical way to support it with the resources. And so you develop a certain mindset with all that. And you know, conversely, you grow up in a very large, you know, city and stuff, or city state. You have a certain mindset built around that. So, you know, it's kind of hard for me to say this, but, you know, in many respects, a lot of the things that we deem right or wrong are relative, depending on the situation and the culture that you come from. But that said, you know, having some sort of guidelines for one group or another, I mean, is that's what people fight about. People are saying, well, you know what, you can't do that. You cannot enslave people. Just because it's part of your culture, it's not part of ours. And we do not like it because we think it's wrong. And, you know, the U.S. went over, you know, we had a, there was a civil war over something, over that matter. And it's, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I don't know. It's, there's so many factors involved that makes it so complicated. And the fact that there are so many people with so many different diverse viewpoints, I don't know.
But it's, I feel like there's that weird balance though. You have like what you were saying, like you, we, it's kind of a thing, a weird thing where it's like you have, again, the extremes of like the world's black and white, or the world's just kind of all relative, you know, and it's all great. But even what, from what you said, it sounds like there is that balance where, you know, there are certain kind of rights and wrongs, like when it comes to slavery or certain things that, you know, that like across different cultures, no matter how different they be, there are certain kind of things that I guess people still, like, you know, killing your parents is just wrong, you know, or whatever it is. There's certain kind of absolutes that I think are pretty standard across societies. But at the same time, there is also that mix of certain, depending on your culture or depending on, you know, the region that you're in, there are some, I guess it does vary, you know, there's that more kind of more secondary part, you know, parts of the culture that might vary from culture to culture. So there is that, I don't know, it feels like there is that mix between kind of absolutes, black and whites, and that grayish area. And yet when we argue or when there's discourse, it tends to be either one or the other. It's either black or and white, or it's, there is no black and white, it's all gray, and you know, there's no standard to hold.
That's
anyone
why
to.
I don't like dogma. This is where I usually have a problem with most organized religion, is I don't like just taking everything as written in stone and can never be changed, because we find out we're wrong a lot about things. And that's where these isms that you're both talking about, I think, really go wrong, is when they say, nope, this is wrong. It's always been wrong. We don't care if conditions have changed. We don't care what's new or what realities on the ground have become, you know, changed the conditions. This, we're not going to change. And that's where you get a lot of these arguments of black versus white, or the reaction of like, well, black versus white doesn't work, so it's all gray, and there is nothing. And usually, what ends up being true is some sort of combination of black and white. That's, I guess, gray, but it's not gray in the sense of there's no meaning to it. It's just like, oh well, that it was sort of like partly down one road, partly down another.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting as technology allows for, you know, the various, you know, various philosophical, religious, and ideas to be, you know, shared and you know, distributed among people. It'll be interesting to see, like, if you were to give everyone a free choice in the matter of what they could do, what they believed in, how they would believe in it or practice it, what people would choose. I mean, you know, for example, oftentimes people think, well, yeah, people are going to want democracy. They're going to want freedom, because that's just a natural tendency of human nature. And I tell them, no, that's the natural tendency of people who grew up in those societies.
That's a natural tendency of some people. There's even people who grew up in those societies who don't want that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, for some people, it's like, oh, my God, you want me to make my own choice? How scary. It's like that whole Simpsons episode where they do an ant experiment on the space shuttle, and there's an accident. The ants, you know, fly out floating into the confines of the space shuttle. And, you know, they subtitle it with the ants saying, oh, my God, freedom, horrible freedom. Yeah. You know, I got to make all these choices and stuff. It's you know, one of the things that I find most disconcerting is to know that.
Well, it's not even, you know.
Oh, go ahead. Well, what I was saying.
Oh no, I was just saying that I think it's not even. Well, last hangout.
I was going to say that what I find most disconcerting, and I think most people do, is when you find out what you've believed in and how you were raised to, you know, believe in it, it suddenly changes, you know, or maybe our way of life isn't the right one. You know, having something like that you've lived your life on and felt confident and secure knowing that this is relatively the right path can suddenly be the wrong one. Like
bell bottoms will always look good, and then suddenly they don't. Everybody's like, those don't look good, and you're like,
you know what? But they came back as flare jeans and bootcut jeans for men.
should we finish up with a couple of
yes.
pieces of feedback? Chandler Bing says, it seemed to me that Bobo was clearly talking about listening to the show live, not participating. I also think you should broadcast live over Google Plus. Bobo666 says, nice to see someone agrees with me. Yeah, Chandler, I think we knew that's what Bobo meant, but there are other people who might think the other way, so we always have to address what other people in the audience might think. We would like to broadcast the Hangouts live. We don't have the ability to do that yet. Google Plus is granting it slowly to people based on how popular they are. So Veronica Belmont got the ability to broadcast her Hangouts, but we haven't yet. So you know, maybe we'll get there soon. Tom T. Walker says, really, it was a coincidence that Brushwood dropped in on a Hangout, not knowing it was East Meets West, then got to plug his new podcast. Seemed a little contrived to me. I could be wrong.
I don't think it was contrived. I think it was just incredibly inconvenient for him.
It really wasn't contrived. I mean, I think he was trying to poke fun at the fact of, you know, doing the plugging, and maybe that sound contrived to you, but we definitely didn't know he was going to do that. And yeah, the echo was annoying. We apologize for that. Hopefully next time that won't happen. And then our only other comment came from you, Derek, about Terms of Service.
Terms? You mean the original series?
No, oh, I'm sorry, about the original series, Star Trek.
Yes, I think Derek probably should read this, but I'll read it for him anyway. TOS definitely was made to have an idyllic view of humanity in the future. The Next Generation eventually tried to move away from the mold with a few episodes that had questionable decisions made by higher-ups in the Federation. A couple of them were real stinkers, I might add. But we don't see a darker side of the Federation until DS9. Like Roger said, suddenly you have a bunch of shadowy organizations within the Federation, conspiracies, lies, etc. A short point to kind of wrap it up real quick is saying that Star Trek tells a story of where mankind has evolved, past problems that plague our society today. Ironically, it's a position that makes Star Trek stand apart from all sci-fi today, that perhaps in reaction to Star Trek, paint a less than perfect human society. I always love Star Trek for that, though. It gives us direction to our strives for and a hope for something better. Yeah, it's really interesting in how utopian Star Trek makes their contemporary, the future contemporary society, at when most kind of future-looking sci-fi series have always kind of wavered between it's a utopian, but secretly it's a fascist regime, or it's a utopian society that will eventually be destroyed by a comet or something like that.
It's a fine line, yeah.
Buck Rogers. I mean, if you think about that, you know, that's a civilization that came out after a horrible war that destroyed most of the planet, and only remnants of humanity remain. All right.
So, Derek, can you let's let you try to talk?
Hello. Oh,
we can't hear Derek now.
Oh, I can't hear.
We can see him, but we can't.
Derek, say something. Oh, I can only see his lips move. I don't hear anything.
His lips move, but you can't hear what he's saying.
That's Colleen, by the way, joining us right at the end of East Meets West. Hey, Colleen.
Well, I'm sorry, but has East met West yet?
Yes.
It's all easted and wested together.
East meets wet.
We had Derek Chen on, but he's still there. We can see him, but suddenly we can't hear him.
I can see him.
Did you hear him, though.
Did you mute your mic, Derek? Are you pushing air over your vocal cords?
Oh, that's a common mistake, actually.
Yeah, some people make. Yeah, no, he's definitely doing that. All right. Well, at least you got to respond via the comment on the blog.
Through my voice.
So, Derek, best of luck in Asia. Have fun on your trip.
Don't drink the water. Personal experience. Don't drink the water.
Yeah, Colleen. Anything to plug?
Nothing to plug.
Did you make the funny did you win millions of bucks?
No, but I think I have enough videos now that I can make the video.
All right. Well, remember us little people when you strike it rich in your inner office rivalry competition.
Colleen has a secret project.
I will
project.
Destroy them, I hope. And if not, I will be terribly embarrassed.
I think, was my the most embarrassing?
From what I can tell so far, yes.
Yeah, figures.
Okay, should we explain what's going on or just leave people to wonder?
I can explain if you'd like.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
If there's time. I work at Google and on video infrastructure. And amongst my team, there's a competition of making a YouTube video, uploading it, and trying to get the most views. And the winner gets to work out of any Google office in the world for a week. And so, of course, this means... Wait, free trip to Japan? Email everyone I know and get them in on this shit. Oh, wait, I probably shouldn't have sworn.
That's fine. Don't worry. Roger's done it.
And I've done it twice.
And so I've got a video that involves lots of people from the internet and television and video, including Roger Chang and Tomas Marit. And I'm going to edit it together and hopefully do something remotely interesting. And if it's not funny, I'll be really embarrassed because I put at least a couple of hours into this.
Well, I hope it works out.
And I gave one of my funniest anecdotes for that. Wow. Most embarrassing anecdotes.
Definitely most embarrassing.
Mine's just stupid, but...
I think funny depends on editing, so I don't know if I'm going to do it justice, but I'll try.
All right.
I could be the cherry on top.
You always are, buddy.
You are, Roger. I know. You're the cherry on top of everyone's sundae.
That's really gross, Tom. I don't ever need to hear that from you again.
And that's it for this episode of East Meets West. You can find us on the web at subbrilliant.com/EMW. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
About this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.